email brendan@rte.ie.
Now, to text here from Kieran, I'm stunned by attitude towards travel by plane to safe countries, and your panel hasn't mentioned the quantity of Americans hanging in our country, hanging around in our country, I presume, every day, walking freely in caps around our shops and restaurants, and the insistence in the Galway pharmacy last week, until this stops, you may as well open Dame Lane pubs. No question about it. We have our heads in the sand on this critical issue. And that's from Kieran. And I want to talk now to Noel Keane, who is a restaurateur down in Tralee. Noel is the owner of Cree Restaurant in Tralee. Noel, I imagine that it's not a time where you would be turning away a lot of business at the moment if you're a restaurant struggling to keep going, but you are turning away business right now.
Yeah, well, yes, I am turning away business right now. I turned them away last week.
Okay, so tell us who they were.
Two groups of Americans.
Okay, and tell me what happened.
Throughout the night, two different groups of Americans turned up at the door looking for a table. And I asked them when they arrived in the country. One group had arrived on Friday, one group had arrived on Wednesday. So obviously neither had been done the quarantine. And I refused to take them on that basis.
And did you ask them if they had done the quarantine, or did you confront them about this?
I asked them both straight out when they arrived, what was their arrival date. And as I said, one group said they arrived on Friday, the other group said they arrived on Wednesday.
And Noel, what was their attitude?
One group, the first group that turned up, I asked them and they said they'd arrived, and I said you hadn't done your quarantine, and due to that I wouldn't be able to accept their at the table. They kind of shrugged and walked away. And the second group asked the same question and got the same answer and said you hadn't done your quarantining, and due to that, like, that I wasn't going to give them a table. And the answer was that I don't have corona and it's all overhyped anyway.
Oh, okay. Were they older people or younger people?
Older.
Okay.
And I just said, you know, look, this conversation is going no further, please leave.
Right. Why did you not take their business?
Well, they're coming from a hotspot. They haven't done the quarantine. And we're just after reopening after nearly 4 months of closure. And I have to worry about the safety of my staff and customers. And it would be uncomfortable for my staff to have them there.
Yeah. Are there a lot of Americans down around Tralee?
They're the only ones I have come across as of yet, as in dealt with a restaurant, you know, to the restaurant door.
Yeah. And I think this story took off on social media and you got some reaction from the US. Is that right?
I did, yeah. I got a huge reaction to it. It happened on Sunday night, and just on Monday morning, I put up a very simple post of, you know, any tourists coming to Ireland, it doesn't matter where you're from, if you haven't quarantined for the 14 days, please don't come to the restaurant for the safety of everybody. Thought no more about it and got an insane reaction to it. People agreeing with us, saying fair play and all of that sort of stuff. And it just took legs. It got into a lot of newspapers. And then a Boston radio station contacted me about it as well. And I was kind of on the fence whether I would talk to them or not, because obviously the reaction could be very different from America than it is here. But the reaction was actually the same of there was people ringing into the show apologising that Americans were here, that they shouldn't be travelling in this. Because even within the States, if you were in Texas to go to New York, you have to quarantine for 14 days. But they're flying in here, getting off the bus or the train or whatever way they come in the plane, and they're walking around town straight away.
Yeah. Okay, and look, we don't want to whip up anti-American sentiment.
No, absolutely not.
And I know that, look, you guys down in Tralee are very reliant on the Americans, and the bus tours are great and at either end of the season and stuff as well. And I know it's a short season for you this year. So, look, Noel, good luck to you and good luck to everyone down in Tralee and everywhere else who's trying to keep people in jobs and turn a buck for the rest of the summer. Okay, thanks, Noel.
Have a great day.
I'm joined by another Kerry man now. Michael O'Regan, political commentator, is here. And we were talking earlier, Michael, about the backstabbing and the nasty business of politics in Fianna Fáil at the moment. So we thought we'd get you in to talk us through some other moments of high drama and I suppose instances where it's a dirty old business, isn't it?
It's a rotten business, Brendan. It's a blood sport. No sentiment. A lot of political bodies left around after warfare. But when you think about it, I'd like to say it's all about ideology and all that. Afraid not. Frequently it's about position, as we saw after the formation of the last government. I mean, the perks are big. To become a TD, it's, you know, big standing in the community, etc. Not to mention becoming a minister, a junior minister, a senior minister. I mean, look at your own native heat at the moment, Brendan. Cork South Central. A Taoiseach and two ministers. I mean, down in Montanati, there must be barely concealed joy and elation. I mean, are they sitting in their drawing rooms watching television saying, there's the Cork minister and the Cork Taoiseach and the second Cork minister and getting a tough time there now from David McCullough and Miriam McCallum, those Dublin people. But more luck to you, Brendan.
But look, Cork is the seat of power right now, you know, and they're bound to be detractors.
The art core of Croke Park and All-Ireland Day will be Cork-dominated. I mean, that's one of the perks. You get free tickets to the All-Ireland, you know. So the stakes are high. It's brutal. It's...
there's never a huge amount of sackings, though, is there? Sacking is kind of unusual.
Yeah, a sacking is unusual because a lot of ministers go perhaps bitterly but quietly. So a sacking in is unusual. And a sacking has a resonance which a resignation doesn't. A sacking means the Taoiseach of the day has fired the minister. And this has ramifications, of course, for the government of the day, but it has also ramifications within the party organisation.
Do you think Micheál Martin had no choice here?
He had no choice when Barry Cowan, and this is a personal tragedy for Barry Cowan, every minister who loses his or her job, there's a family involved, it's personal tragedy. But when Barry Cowan refused to come into the Dáil and make a further statement and take questions, then his position became untenable. Now, I know he has his own views on the matter and they're strongly held and he's expressed them. But from a political point of view, it was the end.
Yeah, now... There have been some sackings, though, and we'll talk about a couple of them. Tell us about the sacking of Brian Lennon.
This is probably the most sensational sacking of all, actually, in the history of Irish politics, because Brian Lennon, in 1990, was Taoiseach and Minister of Defence. He had a successful liver transplant in the United States, and he was the Fianna Fáil candidate for the presidency. The other two candidates were Mary Robinson, who subsequently won, and Austin Curry for Fine Gael. Now, the government at the time was the Fianna Fáil PD government, led by Charles Haughey. Incredible that these two would get together, because some years earlier, Haughey had Des O'Malley thrown out of the party because he refused to vote against Fine Gael Labour coalition bill extending family planning entitlements. The greater availability of condoms was unacceptable to Fianna Fáil. Des refused to vote against it, and he was thrown out for what the Cóiriú called conduct unbecoming. Very nice. So anyway, that's all right. At one stage, and they were all political enemies, Des O'Malley said that Charles saw he was unfit for public office. But look, politics is a practical game. In 89, it made sense from numbers, in terms of numbers, that the two would form a government. And it was working very well. But Fine Gael had a little trap set for Brian Lennon. And it was raised on Questions and Answers, actually, when Gareth Fitzgerald, former Fine Gael Taoiseach, was a panellist. And that is, the question related to the president of the day, the fact that he had never exercised his powers to refuse a dissolution of the Dáil, which, of course, is there.
This was Paddy Hillary.
Paddy Hillary was president at the time. Yeah, yeah. Now, the allegation was from Fine Gael that a number of people in January 1982, when the then Fine Gael Labour government collapsed, that a number of people from Fianna Fáil, including Brian Lennon, had telephoned the Oras in an attempt to persuade Paddy Hillary to refuse a dissolution of the Dáil. The idea being, of course, they'd go back to the drawing board and Fianna Fáil would take over. And when this was raised, Brian Lennon denied it strongly. He said it was a fiction. Now, what followed, Brendan, was a mixture of Watergate, a James Bond movie, with a bit of royalty thrown in, and I'll explain. That was all right. There was a controversy. It might have rested there except, and now we get to the Watergate bit, there was a tape. Jim Duffy was a postgraduate student in UCD, and he had interviewed Brian Lennon on tape, and Lennon had said that he had telephoned the Oris and spoken to Paddy Hillary. So there's a big contradiction. Fine Gael scented blood. They moved a motion of no confidence in the government. The PDs became extremely uneasy, and there was pressure on Lennon to resign.
We have a good clip here. So this is Brian Lennon, and it's RTE's Brendan O'Brien interrupting him on the canvas in Donaghmede Shopping Centre. And Lennon is clearly unaware here that the tape of him admitting to calling Hillary had been made public.
Hello, girls. Mr. Lennon, I'm sure you'd like an opportunity to reply to the latest developments in the telephone call business. The Irish Times today revealed the contents of the tape in which it has you admitting that you made the phone call directly to President Hillary.
I never spoke to President Hillary on that occasion or on any other occasion regarding a constitutional matter.
This is a transcript of the tape here. The question is,
I'm only interested in what I spoke to. Did I or did I not ring or speak to Paddy Hillary on the night in question? I did not ring him, nor did I speak to him. And I have confirmed that that is the correct position, and that what appeared on any other tape is incorrect. That is the position.
OK, he was having none of it, you could say.
But the tape was there.
Yeah.
Now, it matters are reaching ahead. O'Malley and Bobby Malai and Mary Harney, who was the junior minister, were actually drafting their resignations because they felt they couldn't vote confidence in the government. There was a meeting in Kinsale between Charles Haughey and Brian Lennon one morning. And Charlie asked Lennon to resign, and he said he wouldn't. Now, Charlie Haughey had to go to the airport to meet Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, who was coming on a visit. So he left other Fianna Fáil ministers to talk to Brian Lennon. And when he went to the airport, he was naturally asked, not about the royal visit, but the controversy.
And we have the tape here.
Oh, no. Nor did I seek it. I want to make it absolutely clear that anything of that nature is entirely a matter for my old friend Brandon and himself personally. I would not exert any pressure of any kind, nor would any of my colleagues.
That's like a premiership manager being backed fully there, isn't it,
Mrs. Thatcher saying in the House of Commons, her Chancellor of the Exchequer was unassailable and he was gone within hours. But there's a problem about that quote, Brendan, because a few hours earlier in Kinsale, he had asked Brian Lennon to resign. But what he was hoping, of course, was that Brian would act as he knew initiative and resign. Now, matters went ahead throughout the day. Brian Lennon went back on the campaign trail for the presidency. That, at lunchtime, we had a queen in town, Brendan. She had to be treated to lunch. So Charlie, as Taoiseach, had to attend a lunch for Queen Beatrix. In those days, Fianna Fáil and the royalty had their dinner in the middle of the day. So at the lunch, there was exchanges again between Des O'Malley and Charlie Haughey. Charlie returned to Leinster House after the lunch, and he met Brian Lennon again. And on this occasion, he handed him a statement which had been drafted by Charlie's advisers. It was, in fact, quite a long one, a three-page statement about that he was resigning. And there was a crucial line in it. The decision is mine and mine alone. I have not been subject to pressure from any quarter. Now, this was Charlie to his old friend of 30 years, Brian Lennon. They'd served together, Tim Pat Coogan, called Brian Lennon, Charlie Haughey and Donough O'Malley, the men in the mohair suits in the 1960s. They were the dynamic young ministers. Mm. So these two men went back a long way. Lennon refused. He said he wanted time to think about it. And he went off on the campaign trail down the country. He went to Moth in Westmeath. Now, Stephen Collins, in his book, The Haughey File, gives an account of an exchange between two of the people involved in Moat. Bertie Ahern and Padraig Flynn had been sent off by Charlie to keep an eye on Brian, right, trying to convince him to, well, for God's sake, resign, you see. Yeah. Come back to Kinsale and resign. But Brian continued on the campaign trail. Now, Mary O'Rourke, Brian Lennon's sister, who was also in the cabinet at that time, she spotted Padraig Flynn in the crowd. And Padraig Flynn asked her, am I welcome to Westmeath? And Mary O'Rourke said, no, you're not. and told him to clear off back across the Shannon. So, you know, matters were getting very fraught. Brian Lennon and his crowd went off, stayed overnight in Athlone. Now, this is where we get to the James Bond bit. At dawn the following morning, in the house they were staying in Athlone, a helicopter started to hover overhead. And it was Ciarán Haughey, dispatched from Kinsale, with some Fianna Fáil people in an attempt to persuade Brian Lennon to come back to Kinsale and to resign. And he refused. His family refused and his supporters refused. So the helicopter had to go back to Kinsale. He then broke off contact with Charlie, eventually returned to Dublin. He was in a house in South Dublin. There was contact with Charlie. Eventually he refused to resign. And then a letter sacking him was dispatched by car to that house in South Dublin. And Charlie announced it to the Dáil.
And here's Charlie announcing it to the Dáil.
This evening I requested the Taoiseach, Mr. Brian Lennon TD, to resign as a member of the government, and that he failed to comply with this request. Accordingly, I propose to exercise my constitutional prerogative to advise the President to terminate his appointment as a member of the government. Brian Lennon has been a friend, a loyal and trusted colleague for well over a quarter of a century. What I have to do, I do with great sadness and great sorrow.
They don't do it like that anymore, Johnny Fallon, do they? Helicopters, royalty, everything. That was a dirty business, but done with kind of kid gloves, wasn't it?
It was, and I would say, though, Brendan, it was also one of the tripwires to mark the end of CJH from that moment on. And I suppose to nowadays, I try to commentate on politics as fairly as possible. Back in them days, I was a lot more partisan, and of course I was very much involved with Albert Reynolds, and I remember Michael's describing it. The night Lenehan came, he actually came to Lanesborough in County Longford before he went on to Moat and Athlone. And we waited for him in Lanesborough. Eugene Murphy, who's a TD and senator, I was been around at the time too. We went round that town, organising the chant to be sure that when he arrived off that bus in Lanesborough, the chant was no resignation, no resignation, no resignation. And he arrived in, and I remember Albert Reynolds, who was our man, giving a real barnstorming speech off the stage in St Mary's Hall in Lanesborough about no, there was no surrender on this, you know. Everybody was ready for the election. Absolutely everybody. The blood was high in Fianna Fáil at that time. It was a time when the party believed it was an absolute machine for elections. And the idea was, we'll take them all on. We'll fight the presidency and the general election. We'll do it all at once. Bring it on. We're ready for it. But one thing we won't do in Fianna Fáil in that era, we will not sell out one of our best, oldest, most beloved characters. And Brian Lennon Sr., from yeah. I was a kid, I was lucky enough to meet him on a couple of occasions, and he was a brilliant man. And, you know, we were backing him to the hilt in that election. And Fianna Fáil, the emotion of that night, it's hard to recreate now just how the bitterness that was felt, everything yeah. else. And when Haughey did that, from there on in, and I know, as I say again, coming from the Albert Reynolds side, there was a side where Albert had already started on a journey of lacking belief in CJH.
Yeah, because Albert was fired by Haughey ultimately, wasn't he?
He was indeed, yeah. I mean, that was, you know, on that journey, that continued on. We were all on a journey then that said, look, CJ's on borrowed time. You know, he has to go. For us, Albert was the man to go in. Albert had his own plan. And then, you know, the circumstances got to a point. And I remember when on the night, and maybe Michael will want to go into the details on that too, but I remember the night that the four backbenchers, Noel Dempsey, Sean Power, put down the motion of no confidence in Charles Haughey. Albert was coming to our local parish, Newtown Cashel, that night, and the news broke. There's a motion of no confidence, and we knew Albert was going to back this. And ultimately, the great thing about heaves is you lose heaves. I think with the exception of Michael Noonan's heave against John Bruton, you always lose heaves to a leader. Leaders win. The idea is you do as much damage in the heave to make the leader a lame duck, and then you're the obvious choice for the next round when it comes. But it's all about doing damage. Leaders in big parties generally do not lose heaves on the first go, but you have to be willing to be sent to the backbenches, to sit there in exile and say to everybody, there shall be no division, there shall be no healing until you get rid of the leader that we've gone against. And right. That's where the bitterness plays into it.
Now, Hazel, the Greens do not do their heaves like that. This is a very civilised heave you guys are having, isn't it?
I don't like the word heave here, Brendan. Like, first we were called flaky, now we're saying there is heaves. There is no heave. There's a constitutional requirement for a leadership election.
So, was it a requirement? Did you have to do this?
We had to do this and we discussed it.
So you're doing this reluctantly?
No, we're doing this is because it's required and it is what...
Michael,
well, you're not a member of the Green Party.
I've covered Green Party conventions for 30 years, I would say. I remember the Greens when they were run by people like Trevor Sargent and Dan Boyle and others. And the only two people in the media, the only two organisations in the media interested in them actually were the Irish Times and RTE. But there's the option of a leadership contest. There's not a requirement.
No, it is a constitutional requirement, Michael. Let me finish off what I was trying to say earlier on as well, is that listening to yourself and to John there, it's like amazing, this history from different parties, but also how we've put politicians on pedestals, like sounding, like hearing of Brian Lenehan and CJ Hyde and Albert Reynolds. These were all people we put on pedestals and we held them to a higher standard, rightly so. But also, it was a different time. Now, the politician should be the exact same as every other member of the public. Any member of the public should aspire to be able to be in a political position. And that's the thing, that's the divide gone. As such, it's the same when it comes to leadership change. It shouldn't be a massive deal. So at the end of the day, we choose a leader that can lead the party, that can inspire the party, and hopefully next week we'll have the result of that. But what I'm saying, and what
do,
I'm
do
trying
you feel
to...
Eamon Ryan isn't doing that?
I think that for me, you know who I endorsed, and for me, I believe that there is a change required at the moment. We've done, both parties have done the party great service, have led us to this point, but it was also done by a lot of our members. Like, Green Party was built on grassroots membership. Like, in 2013, I remember knocking on doors on my own with the other half who was trying to run, and we only had a handful of volunteers in the office keeping the lights open. Now, Eamon was one of them, so we will always be grateful for that. But so was Catherine. And this is what I don't understand when people go, oh, the Greens are going for heave. We're not. We're going to select a new leader if the members so deem it. If they decide, well, we would like to select Eamon again. Absolutely. So, and this is what I'm also slightly heartened by new politics, especially looking at Micheál sacking Barry Cowan, is that politics have changed. There's no longer this massive drama of when someone does something done.
When you listen to the tribalism of all that,
exactly.
And Johnny talking about the chanting no resignation.
It's
everything.
Mad.
But
so.
You know what? I feel in years to come that when the true story of the Greens now is written, there'll be great drama, because what you have here is you have brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, you know, all these family entanglements, and there are clearly factions in there as well.
I'm sure people will kind of look at it and go, oh, sure, that's a Nancy Drew novel in the waiting, but it's not. It's very much a clear cut. We had, and even I sit on executive, I was there for that meeting when Eamon had said himself, yes, we need to look at leadership election, and that was back in just after February, the two of them, everyone was involved in the decision.
Okay. Lise, give us your favourite heave story.
My favourite heave, I think, when I look back in great fondness, was the one against Enda Kenny in June 2010. It was because it was just so gloriously inept. It was like a bunch of sort of B-movie actors running around a stage with rubber knives. It was extraordinary. And again, it was one of those ones that sort of came more or less out of the blue. I mean, there had been a few, you know, moans about his Enda Kenny's leadership of the party. But it was at a time, the summer of 2010, when, you know, the Fianna Fáil Green government was in meltdown. I mean, everything was a catastrophe.
Remind us who trooped out that day.
Well, the Well, the Callum government came crashed to a halt, you know, a few months later. But
yeah, no. But who were the main conspirators who arrived out that day?
Well, I suppose the first to sort of throw, you know, set the alarm bells ringing was Richard Bruton. I mean, it started with an opinion poll, as they often do.
Yeah, Fine Gael are deadly for that.
Fine Gael are deadly for that, and funnily enough. There's a place, a watering hole across the road from Leinster House, and a gang of us Polcors happened to be in there having a drink, and Enda Kenny was in another corner with some of his pals. We all waved at each other. 9 o'clock news came on. Poll was announced, which actually put the Labour Party in first place as the most popular party, leapfrogging Fine Gael. And we, of course, stampeded over to Enda. And, of course, there was like, you know, the sort of those cartoons when the roadrunner goes over the cliff and there's just a sort of something hanging there, suspended in midair. Yeah. There was his pint. So out anyway, so... That all hell broke loose. Richard Bruton, of course, senior minister, was asked by Miriam McCallaghan on primetime if he supports the leader, and there was that fatal hesitation.
Yeah.
Then there were days of confusion. There was sort of Brian Hayes, Olivia Mitchell, who else? Dennis Nocton, I think, joined, Lucinda Crichton. There was a good gang, but I think it was actually even Brian Hayes said it was like Keystone Cops. I mean, it ended up... Nobody would sort of go out and actually stick the knife in and say, I am definitely going for this. There was dithering, there was secret meetings, there was an absolutely hilariously secret, unsecret meeting in the Green Isle Hotel where the conspirators met to try and figure out what they were going to do, came out. Valerie Cox of this parish was there lying in wait for them, and of course there was sort of Benny Hill chase, you know, back to town. And on the other side, Phil Hogan stepped up to the plate, had heard the rumblings in the undergrowth, had basically started making calls, marshalling the troops, promising this, that and the other.
Sorry to interrupt you. It might have been you, Michael, who used the phrase at the time. I remember reading that Phil Hogan, with a combination of threats and inducements, subdued it all.
He emerged onto the plinth with an army behind him of Kenny supporters.
Yeah.
And the Keystone Cops had to run. You know, and the other thing, of course, is Kenny and Hogan, they handled it very well initially. Kenny sacked his front bench immediately, which, of course, reduced them in status. And there were little nods about Jonah Ministries down the road and all that kind of thing. And Kenny won the day. Interestingly, by the way, on that...
We never knew the result of the ballot, though. It was a secret
ballot.
No, we
never. Fine Gael they're very discreet about this. They keep the bloodletting kind of private. You know.
They burned the ballots afterwards.
They burned the ballots afterwards. Yeah. But it was interesting that Enda Kenny, previously as a chief whip, had been a staunch supporter of John Bruton when John Bruton's leadership had been challenged. Now, there was Richard standing outside trying to take Enda out.
I think what was interesting too with that, going back to that heave, you know, again, it was an idea that I think Richard Bruton wanted or thought that the rest of the cabinet was just going to get behind them and this would be a gentlemanly acceptance of the change in power, which wasn't going to happen, and Phil Hogan wasn't going to let happen. But crucially, Enda Kenny, when it's all over, is like Caesar giving out forgiveness, and he tells them all, with the exception of Dennis Nocton, he tells them, you can come back to the front bench now if Richard Bruton, Simon Coveney, Leo Varadkar, Dennis Nocton had all said, no, we said we didn't have confidence in you then, we don't have confidence in you now, we stay on the back benches, Enda Kenny would have been hamstrung. And there was no getting back from that. That was too powerful a group to sit. But they were too afraid of missing the job, and therefore they went. And weirdly enough, that's how Micheál Martin did it. He refused Brian Cowan's offer to come back into cabinet, and that's what made him leader a little while after.
Okay, Johnny Fallon, thanks a million, guys. I have to take a break. That was great. Michael O'Regan, thank you so much. Lise Han, thank you very much. And Hazel Chew, thank you very much. And we'll take